sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Eric Goldman, author of the fine new book, The American Jewish Story Through Cinema. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week's Torah portion, called Ki Tetzeh, the weekly reading in the synagogue that was taken from the book of Deuteronomy, began with an exploration of some of the laws of warfare, and that got me thinking about the whole issue of war and peace in a religious setting. You know, we prefer to think of our religious doctrines as being dedicated to creating peace, not war. In fact, today, nothing turns someone off to religion more than hearing about religious wars. And I've had many people tell me that they think the greatest cause of war in human history is religion. While that's certainly not true, World War I and World War II, the greatest, most extensive, most terrible wars in all human history, were not religious wars at all, nor were most of the Cold War conflicts. Nonetheless, religion and war certainly strikes an ugly, discordant note. We don't want to think about warfare and belief together. In our own era, the concept of jihad and other forms of Islamic warfare have become distressingly familiar to us in America, and we are only now extracting ourselves from some of the longest conflicts in American history in Iraq and Afghanistan, both tinged with religion. Many people see the Israeli-Palestinian conflict as a kind of religious war, whether it is or not, and there are areas of religious terrorism and warfare in nearly every part of the world. So thinking about the combination of war and religion is common and depressing. The lowlight happened recently in a story in Time magazine that highlighted a new movement of violent Buddhist monks who have been encouraging attacks on Muslims in Burma and Sri Lanka. As a non-Buddhist with an outsider's perspective, it seems to me this is very much the antithesis of how we expect religious leaders to behave, especially Buddhists. Buddhism has the reputation of being a religion dedicated to enlightenment and nonviolence. If Buddhist monks are encouraging religious terrorism, what's next? Switzerland declaring war on Sweden? Peace symbols used as nunchucks? Bashar Assad quoting Gandhi to justify massacring civilians? So when our Jewish scripture, the Torah, teaches us about warfare, the tendency is to want to wash our hands of the whole mess. How can we possibly advocate for peace and claim that our God is Oseh HaShalom, the maker of peace, while at the same time calmly discussing how to go about slaughtering other people in God's name? Isn't it the duty of religion to advocate for peace and denounce all war? Well, in general, this is true, but the sad fact of human civilization is that a war is almost always going on somewhere, and sometimes everywhere in the world, and that the number of years in which this planet has been free of war is very, very few. One calculation I found says that of the 3,400 years of recorded human history, only 250 years have been free of a documented war. That is, once every 15 years or so, we have a year without war. To be honest, that seems wildly optimistic. In my lifetime, I cannot recall a single year in which warfare has not been waged somewhere on our globe. Which makes the agenda of the opening section of last week's Torah reading sadly and strangely appropriate at any time. For it does not begin if you go out to war against your enemy, but when you go out to war against your enemy. Pragmatically, the Torah treats war as the tragic but inevitable result of human conflict. We hate war. We seek to avoid war at all costs. We know that war is destructive to much of what we believe in and pray for. But we also know that there simply are times when it cannot be avoided, when, in our fallible human ways, we will fall into war. Perhaps the best translation is when you have to go out to war. A little more on this subject. There's an old platitude, all's fair in love and war. But the Jewish Torah informs us that all is not fair in war, that we need to restrain ourselves both in our military conduct and in the ways in which we re-enter society. That restraint is essential to our moral claim to serve God through our own actions, to fight for the right. We are obligated to act in ways that sustain and reinforce holiness, even under the exigencies of military necessity. And so our section of Deuteronomy scrupulously outlines the ways in which we must restrain ourselves when forced to engage in warfare. We are not to destroy the productive capacity of the land of our enemies. We are not to exploit captives, women especially, as though they were subhuman. We are to have a cleansing process after battle before we re-engage in civilian society. The contemporary Israeli army, the IDF, has its own code of conduct, the Toharat Neshek, the purity of arms. It's a serious effort to interpret the concept of fighting the right way into practical terms, and fighting only the right way. When Israeli soldiers fail that test, they are held accountable by their own military and their own society. Perhaps the greatest lesson for those of us fortunate enough not to be engaged in war is that if rules can be applied to the harshest form of human interaction, warfare, they can certainly be applied successfully to the lesser friction and human interaction tsoros we experience in our own lives. If our ancestors managed to avoid the worst excesses of warfare, we can learn to avoid the worst excesses that our society presents, the conflicts, arguments, and disputes that damage us and those around us and our world. And then, free of these excesses of conflict, we can resume our task, creating a world of holiness and blessing. Play us in this morning with words of holiness and melodies of blessing. Here's a bit more of our pre-High Holy Day preview of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur music from the Liturgy of Forgiveness and Pardon, Adon HaSlichot, Lord of Forgiveness, as sung at Congregation B'nai Jeshurun in New York. Adon HaSlichot, Amukot,
חטאנו לפניך, רחם עלינו. חטאנו לפניך, רחם עלינו.
אדון בנפלאות, עתיק בנחמות, זוכר במתקוות, זוכר כל היום.
חטאנו לפניך, רחם עלינו. חטאנו לפניך, רחם עלינו.
That was Adon HaSlichot, Lord of Pardon, from the liturgy in preparation for Rosh Hashanah, which begins in just 2.5 weeks, Wednesday night, September 4th. Only something like 16 more shopping days till Rosh Hashanah. Long before that, when we return on To Jewish in just a few moments, we'll meet our guest, Professor Eric Goldman, who'll explain how movies express the American Jewish experience best, right here on To Jewish.
Folks, it's time you experience the Jim Click difference at Jim Click Mazda. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection with two Mazda locations to serve you. The all-new 2014 Mazda 6 is now in stock and ready for immediate delivery. And folks, it's all-new body style. It looks absolutely great. And it's priced at only $249 a month. And the 2013 Mazda 3 is now a bid price of just $15,999. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics.
academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 14th anniversary year. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. Now, it's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel explore the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity for anyone who wants to gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. Taste of Judaism offers daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, plus the very popular Taste of Judaism Family Class, held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class, while kids enjoy Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Vassar at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today. That's 520-327-4501.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Eric Goldman. He's the author of the new book, The American Jewish Story Through Cinema, which is, well, you'll hear a lot about it. He got his PhD in cinema studies from New York University. He's the founder and president of Ergo Media, a video publishing company specializing in Jewish and Israeli video. He's a film reviewer, planned and moderated the Israeli film series for the New York's 92nd Street Y and the Yiddish film series at Hebrew Union College in New York. He has done, well, I don't know, just about everything in teaching and exploring Jewish film. Presently is adjunct associate professor of film studies at Yeshiva University and at Jewish Theological Seminary. Good morning and welcome, Professor Goldman.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
So a lot of us have read books about, oh, Jews were so prominent in the movies and, you know, the Warner Brothers and MGM. And that this is a very different approach. This is a sort of a serious film study exploration of certain key Jewish films and how they show a lot about the American Jewish experience.
Yeah, that's really the thrust. I want people who go to the movies to say, hey, what am I learning about Jewish life when I see a film about Jews in America?
You know, they have changed a great deal, Jewish films. Can you just give us kind of a brief overview of the, in 2 minutes, of the history of Jewish cinema in America, or Jews in cinema in America?
Well, sure. I mean, the first thing is that the Jew in America has changed, and our status in America has changed. So, you know, in the early part of the 20th century, what did most Jews, and most of them were immigrant Jews, what do they want? They wanted a better America for their kids, because they themselves could or couldn't, you know, get through and become part of a broad America for a variety of reasons, language, culture, and so on and so forth. So we see this in a film like The Jazz Singer, which is, you know, one of the first chapters in my book. And the same thing holds true for the people who were making films. Jews became very much involved in the film industry early on because it was accessible to them. It was a good business, and they understood what American moviegoers wanted to see. And this changed. This changed into, you know, before the war, after the war. And what I've tried to do is look at how films reflect changing American Jewry, just as the industry itself has changed. You know, the early movie moguls who controlled movie making, the studio heads, were almost all immigrant Jews. And their children, many of whom went into the business, were American-borns and had a different perspective on life in America. And the films that they made about Jews in America also changed as they changed and as their children changed. So one example is just watching the 1927 Jazz Singer, the way it was remade in its 1950s versions, and there were actually two of them made in the 50s, and the Neil Diamond 1980 version. And Jews in America, you know, today are very much a part of America. We no longer are hungry to join and be invited to the table. We are now the ones inviting to the table. We're part of America.
It's a great overview. We will talk much more with Professor Eric Goldman when we return on Two Jewish and hear what the second jazz singer made in the 1950s was all about when we come back on Two Jewish.
If you're like most people, your biggest purchase is your home. Don't you wish there was someone you could turn to who not only had knowledge and experience, but who truly cared about you? If you're looking to buy or sell a home, you need to know Jill Rich. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. With over 20 years of experience, Jill's one of Tucson's top realtors. She specializes in all kinds of residential property. She can find you a starter house or a castle. Jill will find you the perfect home. While the stock market has wild gyrations, real estate grows in value. If you want to invest in income property, Jill can guide you. And if you're thinking about selling your home, Jill provides a personal marketing program to sell your house fast. You can reach Jill Rich at Realty Executives River Road Office, 615-8400. Jill provides strong representation in a caring way. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. Jill Rich, call 615-8400.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, T-O-O Jewish Radio. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as popular Jewish podcasts. We now welcome our occasionally and inscrutably recurring feature of Two Jewish, the ever-popular Insights of Zen Judaism. Here are three haikus for Jews, koans of Zen Judaism. Testing the warm milk on her wrist, she sighs softly, but her son is 40. And is one Nobel Prize so much to ask from a child after all I've done? And finally, 7-foot Jews slam dunking in the NBA. My alarm clock rings. Those were three Zen Judaism insights for the week. Haikus for Jews, for you, a little enlightenment. When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we've been talking about Egypt and the complexity of that culture and that country, which is also like spectacularly poor with some extremely rich people. You know, it's that huge polarity that causes innate tension in a society, unless you've got lots and lots of police and military and secret police, which they also have, which still isn't keeping the lid on. Jewish community goes back forever there, maybe to Moses, maybe to, you know, Joseph. It's almost gone. Kind of a weird question. What happens when there really aren't any Jews left in a country like Egypt that has arguably nearly 4,000 years of Jewish history?
Are you saying that the absence of Jews has caused the current political chaos? I don't understand the context of the question.
People talk about the impoverishment of culture in Central Europe since the Holocaust.
Right.
You know, the Jews were, for a long time in Egypt, the people who were, there were many educated people in Egypt, of course, there's great Islamic universities, but Jews were a very important commercial class in Egypt. And I wonder how much of the sort of general breakdown of society has some relationship to the eventual exodus of all the, really nearly all the Jews now.
I'd be hesitant about overstating the role of the Jewish community.
Wait a minute, I'm a rabbi. I always overstate the role of the Jewish community.
keeping the economy of Egypt afloat. I mean, also you neglected to mention a really important minority, which are the Coptic Christians.
Right,
I mean,
who are also Egyptian experiencing church. A lot of challenge now.
Well, many of them have fled. There's a huge Coptic community, for example, in Vienna, which I actually interviewed a young woman who was applying to Harvard, who grew up in Vienna, and she was an Egyptian Copt, and she told stories which, you know, were valid certainly from her point of view of persecution of Christians and discrimination against Christians by what was then not an Islamist government. It was theoretically a secular government, but society had become somewhat Islamist, and her family had fled and raised her in Vienna. So, I mean, that's an important group too, and they were also merchants and craftspeople, and they had many of the same jobs and occupied many of the same niches in society as Jews did. So, you know, I'd be real careful about overstating the role of the missing Jewish community, which is probably down to, I don't know, double digits at this point.
Yeah, probably not triple digits anymore.
No, sadly. But what I would say is that any country in the world which has a huge disparity between rich and poor will be under some kinds of pressure. And I think one of the things actually that we're seeing in our own country now is that as the disparity between rich and poor grows, and it has grown over the past decade or two, we're starting to see developments of, say, more extremism, a little bit more violence. We're seeing political developments and cultural developments that are new because the degree of the disparity between rich and poor is new.
Very interesting. You know, not the analogy I would have thought of, but you're certainly right. We will talk next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A 25-year-old girl tells her mother that she thinks she's pregnant. Worried, the mother goes to the drugstore, buys a pregnancy kit, and the test shows that the girl is, in fact, pregnant. Shouting at her, crying, the mother says, "Who is the pig that did this to you? I want to know." Without answering, the girl picks up the phone, and half an hour later, a Mercedes stops in front of the house. A mature and distinguished man with gray hair wearing a yarmulke steps out of the car and enters the house. He sits in the living room with the father, the mother, and the girl and tells them, "Your daughter has informed me of the problem. Sadly, I can't marry her because of my personal family situation, but I'll take charge. I'll pay all costs and provide for your daughter for the rest of her life. Additionally, if a girl is born, I'll bequeath 2 retail furniture stores, a deli, a condo in Miami, and a $10 million bank account. If a boy is born, my legacy will be a chain of jewelry stores and a $20 million bank account. But, you know, if there's a miscarriage, I'm not sure what to do. What do you suggest?" All are silent until the mother places a hand firmly on the gentleman's shoulder and says, "So, you'll try again." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish Just For You. You should live and be well and try again. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Ki Tavo in Deuteronomy, which begins with an unusual declaration. When we come into the land that the Lord our God will give us as an inheritance, we are to take the first fruits of our produce, bring them to the priest, and say this formula: "My father was a wandering Aramean. He came to Egypt, few in number, became a great nation there. The Egyptians dealt harshly with us and enslaved us, but God brought us out with a great hand and an outstretched arm, brought us to this place, flowing with milk and honey." The formula given for what we're supposed to say when we bring our offering to the tabernacle is interesting. It includes 2 of the truly enormous elements in our people's history, the exodus from Egypt and the entry into the land of Israel. But it also omits a crucial event, the giving of the 10 commandments, the Torah at Sinai. This is a fascinating, even a shocking omission. After all, the 3 most important parts of Jewish identity are God, Torah, and Israel. When you omit one of those, in this case Torah, you really don't have the fullness of Judaism. And it's ironic that here in the Torah itself, what is missing is Torah. So where did it go? Well, to start, in biblical times, our people were an agricultural nation living on the land. The most important religious experiences were farming-related, planting crops, harvesting them, dividing them up. The connection to the land itself and the labor needed to produce food from it was absolutely central to our identity. That land was Eretz Yisrael, the Holy Land of Israel, and our intimate and permanent relationship to that land was forged over centuries of daily labor and life. When Zionism reconnected Jews to the land in the 19th century in a real, tangible, practical way, it revived the whole experience of loving and serving God by creating food from the very earth, Amotzi Lechem Min Haaretz. God, too, is at the heart of the experience of Jewish life in the times of the Bible. In Ki Tavo, we are commanded to bring this agricultural offering to God in the tabernacle or temple, and there to thank God for all we have. And we are to remember the great gift of freedom that God conferred upon us by miraculously redeeming us from Egyptian slavery. Everything comes from God. A good lesson today, as in the days of Deuteronomy. So, we have God and Israel here, but clearly the third part of Jewish identity, Torah, was less crucial to our Deuteronomic ancestors than the other two parts. Why? And how did Torah become so central later? As farmers in our own land, the need to study Torah seemed less urgent. We had an immediate relationship with the land, and we needed God for the basics that make agriculture possible: rain, sun, and soil. The importance of Torah was diminished when we lived on the land itself. But when we were sent into exile and forcibly torn from our land, we needed Torah. In fact, without the study of Torah, Judaism would not have continued to exist, and our people of Israel would have faded into the dust of history, like so many others did. Only Torah preserved us, gave us the moral foundation and the religious identity to not only survive, but thrive. When we read in Ki Tavo, in the Torah, of course, that we are to give a tenth of all that we have earned to charity, to the poor, the homeless, the widow, and the orphan, we are following an ancient practice, perhaps more than 3,000 years old, an agricultural observance designed for an ancient people in a land of long ago. But we are also using this remarkable text, the Torah, to teach us how to live today. And therein lies the true genius of Judaism. For wherever we are in the world, it is the Torah that binds us together and makes possible our unity as a people. It is the Torah that reminds us to worship God and of our connection to the land of Israel. Paradoxically, even when the Torah seems to be absent, as it appears in our portion of Ki Tavo, it is actually central in our religion and in our lives. When we come back on Too Jewish this morning, our guest, Professor Eric Goldman, will explain why cinema teaches us a great deal about ourselves and what it means to be Jewish in America. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish.
Environmental Strategies Incorporated was established in Arizona almost 15 years ago. They're a corporation that's very unique and has distinguished itself as one of the foremost environmental remediation companies in Arizona. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is also a full-service general contractor. The fact that they have two divisions affords their clients the opportunity to work with one contractor to deal with environmental problems as well as their building and remodeling needs. Environmental Strategies clientele range from single-family homeowners to multi-million dollar Fortune 500 companies. So, if you're in need of asbestos abatement, mold remediation, or general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies at 884-1114. And, if you wish, ask for Ken Goodman, the president. He'd be more than happy to talk with you about your project. That's Environmental Strategies, 884-1114.
Folks, it's time for you to experience the Jim Click Kia difference. Get more discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection. 2013 Kia Soul is now starting at just $14,988 and only $159 a month. So drive home the fuel-efficient 2013 Kia Rio, special event price only $159 a month. And remember, every Kia comes with a 10-year, 100,000-mile warranty. More discounts, more peace of mind, and more selection, 10 brands to choose from. That's the power to save. That's the Jim Click difference. Kia, the power to surprise.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In preparation for the Israeli-Palestinian peace talks that began in Jerusalem last week, Israel released 26 Palestinian inmates, including many convicted in grisly murders, angering families of those slain by the prisoners. These prisoners were welcomed as heroes into the West Bank and Gaza. Buses carrying the inmates departed the Ayalon prison in central Israel late at night, a release aimed at preventing the spectacle of prisoners flashing victory signs. Relatives of the victims, many with their hands painted red, symbolizing the blood on the hands of these inmates, held protests throughout the day. Some protesters tried briefly to block the buses from leaving, while the Israeli Supreme Court rejected their right to keep the prisoners in jail. The decision to release the men stirred anguish in Israel. Many Israelis view them as terrorists. Most of the prisoners were convicted of murders, including of Israeli civilians, soldiers, and suspected Palestinian collaborators. Others were involved in attempted murder or kidnapping. Celebrations erupted in the West Bank and Gaza, where thousands of Palestinian well-wishers awaited the buses. Fireworks lit the sky in Gaza. Rival Hamas and Fatah supporters, including several masked gunmen, celebrated to the beat of drums. Some danced, others flashed those victory signs and waved Palestinian factional signs and flags. Cars with loudspeakers blasted nationalist songs. Palestinians hurled rocks at the Israeli military vehicles escorting the bus convoy when it reached a crossing into the West Bank at 1 a.m. In the West Bank, the released prisoners were met by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas personally at the presidential compound. Later, they laid a wreath at the grave of the late Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. Abbas delivered a short speech congratulating the prisoners and said he will not rest until they are all released. There are about 4,500 Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. You are just the beginning. The rest will come, Abbas said. This release was part of an agreement brokered by the U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry to get Israel and the Palestinians back to the table for peace talks that have been paralyzed for 5 years since 2008. In all, 104 convicts will be released in four batches, although their freedom is contingent on progress in the peace talks. Among those released last week was a Palestinian convicted in the 1994 slaying of Isaac Rotenberg, a 69-year-old Holocaust survivor murdered by an axe as he was working at a construction site. Other prisoners who were released were convicted in the slayings of Ian Feinberg, an Israeli lawyer murdered in a European aid office in Gaza in 93, and Frederick Rosenfeld, an American slain while hiking in the West Bank in 89, among other atrocities committed by these now free Palestinian terrorists. In other news, it's heating up in the Sinai in southern Israel, and that has nothing to do with the late summer weather. Last week, the Israeli military shot down a rocket launched from neighboring Egypt toward a popular Red Sea resort, Eilat, and an al-Qaeda-linked militant group claimed responsibility for the terror attack, fueling concerns that jihad groups are trying to disrupt the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty. It was the first time Israel has deployed the Iron Dome rocket defense system in Eilat, usually placid resort near Egypt's Sinai Peninsula that is popular with Israeli and European tourists. The incident came after days of heightened tension along the Egypt-Israel border, fueled by an Egyptian crackdown on terror groups. The area has experienced increased terrorist activities since the ouster of longtime Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak 2 years ago. Israel's defense minister, Moshe Ya'alon, said the Iron Dome system shot down a Grad-style Katyusha rocket fired from Egypt. There were no injuries. Ya'alon said it was no coincidence that the Iron Dome had been deployed near Eilat. In general, in Sinai now, as we have seen for a long time, there's radical Islamic terror that mainly attacks the Egyptian military and police, but is also trying to attack Israel. 2 weeks ago, Israel briefly closed Eilat's airport in response to unspecified security warnings. The next day, five men believed to be Islamic terrorists were killed in the Sinai, and a rocket launcher there was reportedly destroyed, according to Egyptian officials. Egyptian officials also attributed last week's strike to a drone fired from the Israeli side of the border, but Israel has not replied. Two terrorist websites posted a statement by an al-Qaeda-linked group claiming responsibility for the failed attack. The Mujahideen Shura Council in the environs of Jerusalem has claimed to carry out similar attacks in the past. Statements included details about the strike, including the type of rocket and the time it was fired.
These are the days of miracle and wonder. This is the long-distance call. The way the camera follows us in slow-mo. The way we look to a song. The way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in a corner of the sky. These are the days of miracle and wonder. And don't cry, baby, don't cry, don't cry.
Last week, the world's first lab-grown hamburger was introduced and taste-tested. The event seems full of promise for environmentalists, animal lovers, and vegetarians. but perhaps also for fans of kashrut. The question arose, is a lab-grown burger kosher? And if so, could it actually be parv? This burger was created by harvesting stem cells from a portion of cow shoulder muscle that were multiplied in petri dishes to form tiny strips of muscle fiber. About 20,000 of the strips were needed to create the 5-ounce burger. It was financed partially by Google founder Sergey Brin, who's Jewish, and unveiled by Mark Post of Maastricht University in the Netherlands. PETA, the animal rights group, hailed the event as a first step towards humanely producing meat products. A University of Amsterdam study shows that lab-grown meat could significantly reduce the environmental impact of beef production. For kosher Jews, the cultured burgers could open the door to radical dietary changes, namely the birth of a kosher cheeseburger. That's because meat produced through this process could be considered parv, neither meat nor dairy, according to Rabbi Menachem Ganak, the CEO of the Orthodox Union's kosher division and a former guest of Two Jewish. Thus, under traditional Jewish law, the burger would be paired with dairy products. Several key conditions would have to be met to create kosher parv cultured beef. The tissue samples would have to come from an animal that had been slaughtered according to kashrut rules, not from a biopsy from a live animal, Ganak said, which would violate a different biblical prohibition. The principle underlying this theory is much like the status of gelatin in Jewish law. Though it is derived from an animal, it is not meat. The OU actually certifies some bovine-derived gelatin as parv. It's too complicated to explain even on this august radio show. Ganak also noted another source for viewing cultured meat as parv. A 19th century Vilna-born scholar known as the Heshek Shlomo wrote that the meat of an animal conjured up in a magical incantation would be considered parv. May not be too much of a stretch to apply the same logic to this kind of modern genetic wizardry. Kosher chefs, however, are not yet heating up their parv griddles yet. The lab-born burger costs $325,000, and it took 2 years to make. It is a long way from market viability, kosher or otherwise. However, if mass-produced, it might still cost $30 a pound. I'll believe it when I see it, said Jeff Nathan, the executive chef at Abigail's on Broadway, famous kosher restaurant in Manhattan, and another past guest of Two Jewish. Until it's in my hands and I can touch it, smell it, and taste it, I don't believe it. Even if cultured beef becomes commonplace, consumers still might not be interested, said Ellie Rosenfeld, a spokesman for Empire Kosher, the nation's largest kosher poultry producer. Parv burgers made of tofu and vegetables have been on the market for years, Rosenfeld said. Customers are still looking for the real deal, a product that's wholesome and genuine. That is, you know, meat. Nevertheless, Nathan sounded an enthusiastic note about the potential for parv meat. I'm all for experimentation and science. Let's see what it tastes like. The days of miracle and wonder indeed. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Eric Goldman. He's the author of the new book, The American Jewish Story Through Cinema, a terrific book that explores the role of Jews in film, both actually in writing and creating, but what you see on screen and what that shows about Jews and our place in American society. You mentioned earlier in the show that there were two jazz singer versions made in the 50s. I know the Al Jolson one, the first talkie. I know the Danny Thomas one, in which a Lebanese guy plays the Jewish cantor, son, and singer. And then the Neil Diamond one. Yes, and he does a good job. Frankly, a better job than Neil Diamond did, to be honest. A little inside information. My dad was asked to be the technical consultant on the Neil Diamond version of the Jazz Singer, and he just didn't like the script. So a good friend of ours is actually the cantor that Neil Diamond pushes aside, Uri Frankel of blessed memory. So tell us about the second 1950s Jazz Singer, because I don't think I know that one.
Well, you know, it's funny. Jerry Lewis grew up in a traditional home, and he decided that he wanted to remake it for television. He even brought in Molly Pekin to be his mother. And instead of it being about someone who wants to, who wants to become a jazz singer, it's really someone who doesn't want to follow his father, the cantor, and decides that he wants to be a nightclub entertainer and a comedian and sing. So it's just fascinating. For years, Lewis claimed that he had never made such a TV program. And there were even efforts to destroy it. But the family has now taken great pride in that TV series and actually has released a new restored version of that TV program, which has just been released this year on DVD.
Fascinating. See, you know, there's so much depth and breadth in the Jewish experience in the cinema, but that's a very interesting story. We're used to the control exerted by the movie tycoons, who frankly were nearly all Jewish in the early days of film, and went to great lengths to kind of hide that fact from the viewing public, if not from the people around them. When that control begins to wane, in your book you show how certain authors and directors begin to sort of create a different image of Jews. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Well, movies changed a great deal. Really, there were two major time periods during which movies changed. One was the early 1930s, when there was a lot of pressure exerted on the movie makers, by the Catholic Church, in fact, to change the kind of movies being made. They wanted more of a classical film, and you also see Jews disappearing from the screen in the 1930s. So you have that period and the impact that it had on movie making, and then you also had the demise of the studio system in the 1950s, when suddenly, you know, the studios no longer exerted the kind of control that they had during the previous half century. So independent studios came into being. You have films that were suddenly being made by independent producers. So a film like Exodus in 1960 is not made by a studio because the studio really doesn't want to make it. And so Otto Preminger comes along and buys it away from MGM and makes Exodus. That's just one example of many films. And as a result, you start to see more of an expression and an appearance of Jews in movies in the 50s and 60s, to the point where you're starting to see films about Israel in the early 50s made by independent studios, because the major studios were not ready to be connected with anything too Jewish, you know, right. the name of your program. So that changes, and suddenly we begin to see Jewish heroes in the 60s, and then, you know, you're seeing a lot of independent films from there on in as the studios really become more distributors than producers.
In talking about the studio system, two movies, Gentleman's Agreement and better known in Crossfire, deal with anti-Semitism. Those were not such easy movies to make, were they?
They were not. And in fact, when word got out in late 1946 that 20th Century Fox had bought the rights to make Gentleman's Agreement, a film about anti-Semitism, who were the ones who tried to discourage, we'll use that term, discourage production? As strange as it may seem, it was not only the Jewish producers themselves, and 20th Century Fox was the only major studio run at the time by a non-Jew, Darrell F. Zanuck. The Jewish producers held a meeting, put pressure on Zanuck, brought in Moss Hart, who had been brought in to write the screenplay for Gentleman's Agreement, and said to him, you know, this is a disgrace, it's bad for the Jews, you shouldn't do this. And then the Jewish defense agencies, who do such wonderful work and have throughout the century, they came in and they tried to dissuade Zanuck and also producer Dori Shari at RKO Studios from making his film about anti-Semitism. So we were scared. I mean, the reality is, in the 1940s, anti-Semitism was at an all-time high, which, if you think about it, is kind of strange, considering it was right after the Holocaust and after the American victory in World War II. And here we have Jewish producers scared, not wanting to tackle anti-Semitism. Let's handle it quietly, they said. But Darrell F. Zanuck, who was a fine American, a real patriot, said, I'm not going to stand by. This is bigotry. This is not acceptable in an America that I want to live in. This is not what I want my children's America to be. So he takes it head on. And it's a fascinating story in terms of the struggle the Jewish community opposing a movie, movies about anti-Semitism.
Fascinating. You know, and this is after the Holocaust.
After the Holocaust.
Stunning.
The other piece of interesting information is that Anti-Defamation League, which does so much wonderful work, came in at the tail end and said, you know what, we're going to study this. We're going to see the impact of these films and whether indeed they create more anti-Semitism or whether they, you know, create a situation where anti-Semitism in America drops. And the studies show that these films had a major impact on bringing anti-Semitism down in America. So we see just in these two films what movies can do. We've seen it in other films. We certainly saw it in Steven Spielberg's Schindler's List with the impact that that had on understanding the Holocaust. Movies are impacted by the times and impact the times.
Really a remarkable way of demonstrating it, and that episode maybe as much as anything in the book. I really have to commend you on the way that you dig into a couple of more recent films. The Barry Levinson movie about Baltimore, the you know, really has two, but Avalon, wonderful exploration of Jewish identity in that period. Talk a little bit about that.
Barry Levinson, who grew up in Baltimore, decided he wanted to explore his own experience. He's a brilliant writer and director. And so he made a couple of films. He made Tin Men and Diner. And then he decided he wanted to show, you know, his grandparents' arrival in America and what happened to subsequent generations. And he does this in Avalon. And I have to tell you, my wife and I came out of the movie when it first opened in New York in 1990. And my wife, who comes from Montreal, looked at me and she said, "There was nothing Jewish in that film." And I looked at her, and I grew up in Philadelphia, and I said, "Well, it's so Jewish just by the fact that it's not over-the-top Jewish. I mean, you know, you don't see any Hanukkah celebrations, no Passover Seder, no Rosh Hashanah service, but that's American Jewry in the middle part of the 20th century, at least outside of New York City and Los Angeles."
Right.
Yeah. So that's really, he captures it, and I focus in on a couple of sequences in the film where, in my mind, Levinson really puts his finger on where American Jewry was right after World War II. It's a beautiful story of the first part of the 20th century in American Jewish life in America, and then in his next film, which he made 9 years later, by the way, he was criticized in the Jewish press for not being Jewish enough.
Well, I will say Armin Mueller-Stahl's accent was from somewhere in Central Europe, but never sounded Jewish at all to me. But when I think it's Leo says, "You cut the turkey without me," you know, that's just an enduring image forever.
Yeah. Jacoby, just, you know, that's Lou one Jacoby. Of those moments where, you know, every Thanksgiving someone tells me that they've been together with the family and they and somebody comes in and says, "Oh, you're not waiting for me? I'm late? You cut the turkey without me?" Yeah, it's a beautiful moment. And you know, 9 years later, Levinson returns, really not expecting to have made a fourth Baltimore movie, and this time he focuses on one Jewish calendar year in his film Liberty Heights, and starts on Rosh Hashanah and it ends on Rosh Hashanah, and it's about the next part of the 20th century after 1954, and the impact that that 1954 and the Brown versus Board of Education decision by the U.S. Supreme Court had on American Jewry.
So, jumping a little bit, one of my favorite Jewish films, Everything is Illuminated, gets a chapter in your book, and it's an extremely interesting one. You know, there have been a lot of terrific Jewish films made in the last 15, 20 years. Tell me why you chose this and some of the other interesting stories in it.
Well, you know, it's funny because this is the one film that I've been criticized for including. I think it's one of the best films of the last two decades.
My wife, by the way, thinks it might be the best, and I think it's terrific, too.
And I have to tell you, I think it's certainly, you know, I can count on one hand. It's wonderful. The issue here is some people say, well, why is it in the book? It's really about a trip to Ukraine. And I said, well, that's the whole point. You know, where is American Jewry in the 21st century? And you have a lot of young people for whom, fortunately and unfortunately, the Holocaust becomes their sole Jewish experience. And I think it struggles with that, and it struggles with the whole question of Jewish identity in the 21st century and our connection or non-connection with our Eastern European roots, at least for most of us. It just resonates. And you have an incredibly talented author who wrote the original novel, Jonathan Safran Foer, and you have Liev Schreiber, who I've had a chance to get to know, and I have to tell you, he is one of the most amazing Jewish Americans I've ever met. A guy who feels very strongly about his Jewishness, has shown it in some of the films he's made, and decided to take, you know, an actor gets paid a lot of money for making one film over the course of a few months, and when an actor takes off to write and direct a film for which they're getting very little money, that says a lot about that particular person's commitment to a subject or story.
You know, it's a fascinating story, and he doesn't have much of a Jewish background. That came out in the book, too, which was not something I knew. I just sort of assumed a guy named Lev, you know, should be have some Jewish background.
You know, he talked to me about the impact that his grandfather had on him, mm-hmm. and especially at Seder time. And when his grandfather died, there was a big void left in his life because his parents did not provide that Jewish education for him. So he struggled, and this was for him an opportunity to come to grips with his own Jewish identity. And by the way, we've seen that in the case of, you know, several filmmakers over the last decade or two, and they're turning to cinema as a way of expressing their Jewishness, which is wonderful.
And you know, definitely a new and positive turn in this American Jewish story. By the way, there's a fabulous photo in the book which shows Jonathan Safran Foer, the author of Everything is Illuminated and one of the kind of most popular Jewish authors today, and Elijah Wood, and they both look about 14 years old. On the set of Everything is Illuminated. It's incredible.
Right.
I want to thank Professor Eric Goldman for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Too short, we'll have to do it again. His book is called The American Jewish Story Through Cinema. It's available everywhere books are sold, which nowadays is mostly Amazon. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you so much for including me. Take care.
You too. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical playout on Too Jewish.
A Taste of Judaism, the largest and most successful outreach program in the country, celebrates its 14th anniversary year. Over 5,000 people have completed the course offered by Temple Emmanuel, Arizona's first congregation. Now, it's your turn. Taste of Judaism is free and open to all, Jewish or not. Rabbi Sam Kohan and Rabbi Batsheva Appel explore the history and practice of Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on spirituality, values, and community. Taste of Judaism is an exciting opportunity for anyone who wants to gain an understanding of Jewish culture, history, rituals, community, and practice. The class includes delicious tastes of traditional Jewish foods. Taste of Judaism offers daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, plus the very popular Taste of Judaism Family Class, held at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Adults enjoy a grown-up taste class, while kids enjoy Jewish stories, crafts, and activities with excellent THA teachers. There's no fee or obligation, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila Vassar at 520-327-4501 for more information and to register today. That's 520-327-4501.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for joining us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Congressman Ron Barber, talking about his recent trip to Israel. Our playout this morning comes from the Beth Abraham Youth Chorale, conducted by Cantor Sholem Caleb. It's called Shomer Yisrael, from the Liturgy for the Period of the Slichot Prayers in Preparation for the Jewish High Holy Days, Guardian of Israel. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.